Welcome, everybody. This is Arnaldo, your host of Tommy's Holiday Camp, coming to you every Friday night. Thank you, Bossy and Bessie. Oh, yes. Coming in from the deliquescent fields of Sebastopol. Welcome, everybody. Thank you, Laura, for your wonderful show. Great music. And, yes, Arnaldo of Cows, KOWSLP, Community Radio, the heart of West County Broadcasting on 92.5 and on www.kows.fm to the world. And I'm going to go into some music because I'm going to be calling my guest Breen Newsom, the activist from North Carolina, who about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, she brought down the Confederate flag in Columbia, the state capital of South Carolina. And well, we know what else has been happening with monuments of late. And, hang on in there and we'll get her on the phone on the phone. And let's do, sorry, Houston. And, wow, what a thing. So let's do, think about them, a bit of Stevie Ray Vaughan and Flood Down in Texas. Should be there. Oh, it's on the computer. Yes, Flood Down in Texas, Stevie Ray Vaughan. And our thoughts and wishes go out to all those in, obviously, not just the Houston area, into Louisiana. Hopefully they recover well from the floods. So, I'd like to, with great pleasure, like to welcome Bree Newsom to Cows. Hi, Bree.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure, and to have you here. And wow, what times we're living in.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, for those of you who don't know about Bree, obviously you came to major attention a couple of years ago, bringing down the Confederate flag in Columbia in the State House there in South Carolina. And that certainly does echo what's happening now. You were, I mean, ahead of the game in terms of your reaction was to do with the Charleston Emanuel Church massacre, wasn't it?
Yes. And, you know, I wouldn't necessarily describe myself as being ahead of the game, because the controversy over, you know, Confederate monuments, that has existed for some time. And even in the case of the flag there in South Carolina, you know, there had been boycotts of the state going on over that issue. NAACP had called for a boycott. NCAA was not hosting championship games.
Right.
But you're correct. The massacre in Charleston, that really brought a refocus on the flag, especially once the images emerged of Dylann Roof, who was the white supremacist who committed the mass shooting there at Mother Emanuel. You know, the images came out of him burning the American flag and waving the Confederate flag. And he drove to Charleston from Columbia, South Carolina, where, you know, the Confederate flag had been on display at the State House since 1961. And so, you know, logically, attention, you know, refocused on that issue. And I think for me and those who were involved in the action with me, the turning point was when South Carolina refused to lower the flag even to half staff. And that was in part because of a law that they had passed. So, like, the flag was originally raised over the dome of the Capitol in 1961, you know, as a statement against the civil rights movement, which was at its peak at that time. And then in 2000, you know, they made this compromise to move it to a flagpole. And part of that compromise was that the flag couldn't be lowered for any reason. So even as they were, you know, preparing to bury the victims, you had the American flag and the state flag of South Carolina at half staff, and the, you know, Confederate flag still flying full staff, you know.
Whew, ouch. Yeah. That must have been quite jarring, and that's why one of the reasons why I wanted to be able to chat with you, because obviously here in California, you know, we don't have that that in your faceness of what happened in the Civil War, and so it's hard to imagine what that's like. Can you tell us what it's like living? You know, you've lived in the South virtually your whole life. There they are. On street corners and public plazas, before this happened, what was the general feeling?
Well, I think it's something that's always there, right? And I think when you know, kind of look at the history of the United States, it's like racism is this pervasive factor in life. It's everywhere, regardless of geography, but it kind of ebbs and flows in terms of the tension. So, you know, I was born in Durham, North Carolina. I did all my grade school in Maryland, which is, you know, kind of a like a border state, basically,
right,
between the North and the South. So there's a, you know, kind of a unique kind of culture and tension there in some ways. I went to college in New York, so I kind of saw, you know, like these different dynamics, basically, like over the course of my life. But, you know, when I would be in the South or when I would be in South Carolina, I mean, there was no mystery, you know, about what the Confederate flag meant. And obviously, it, you know, it was something that was very visible. So, you know, it's not so much that, you know, the South is uniquely racist. I think it's just that there obviously is the history of the Confederacy there. And so, like, when you look at you know, the documentation of, like, where Confederate monuments are, for instance, you know, of course, they are mostly concentrated in the South. So in that way, it is kind of a more in-your-face, you know, type of symbol.
Right. And especially because a lot of them were actually erected much later than the Civil War, in the 20s and the 60s, even, I've been reading.
Absolutely. And see, that's part of, you know, I would say some of the miseducation, not just around the history of the Civil War, but particularly around these monuments and symbols. There were even some folks who thought that the flag in South Carolina had been there since the Civil War, you know, not knowing that that flag was raised in 1961. They said at the time that they raised it that it was to honor the 100th anniversary of the Civil War, but we all know the Civil War began in 1860. They raised it in response to sit-in protests that were going on, including the Friendship Nine. That was a group of students in Rock Hill, South Carolina, that staged a sit-in protesting segregated lunch counters and things like that. So even, you know, most of the monuments, including the one that was pulled down in Durham recently that made national headlines, most of those were erected like in the early 20th century, and they were built to basically, you know, make the same statement that you know, the South may have lost the Civil War officially, but in terms of, you know, policy, in terms of Jim Crow laws and segregation and things like that, that was still very much the law of the land. And so erecting these monuments to the so-called lost cause was basically to send that message to everyone that this is still very much the power structure of the South.
Whew. Yeah, it's that's a tough one. It's like having a you know, I came from England, like having Nazis, statues of Nazis in Trafalgar Square or something. It's that would be tough.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, that's the exact meaning of it. And, you know, when these statues were erected, that's also like when lynching was at its peak. Mm. So you have these monuments going up at the same time that, you know, the black codes are being passed, that segregation laws are being passed, that black people are regularly being lynched, you know, and hung from trees in this kind of public, you know, this public display of terrorism. So all of these things are connected. And then just recently, you know, as we've had this growing call for the monuments to come down, we had an instance in Missouri where someone vandalized a Confederate monument, and then a Missouri state representative called for that person to be lynched. So there really is no separation between, you know, these monuments and the violent history that they represent.
Yeah, people are clinging to them, it appears.
Absolutely.
It's like a security blanket, isn't it?
Yeah, not just a security blanket, but, I mean, what they represent, right? So not just the monument, but the social order that the statues represent. And that's why they become such a hotbed, such a kind of flashpoint issue. Because, I mean, like, just practically speaking, right, the flag in South Carolina or a monument, we're talking about a symbol. We're talking about fabric attached to a metal pole. We're talking about, you know, metal. And a lot of these Confederate monuments, to be frank with you, were not even well made, including the one that was taken down in Durham. They were like mass produced. You have like several copies of the same monument that were built all over the South and put up really as part of this campaign to kind of rewrite history. So it's not even just about the monument itself, but really about the power structure that is represented by the monument.
Yeah, I mean, we can tear down monuments, but yeah, how do you tear open a heart and change that?
Yeah, well, I mean, absolutely. And again, I think just as the monument is symbolic of a power structure, taking it down is symbolic of dismantling it, right? So I think that one of the possible dangers, I would say, that we face is to take the monuments down and then say, okay, we've done, you know, everything that needs to be done because the monuments are gone. But what really needs to happen is, like, as we are taking them down, they need to be accompanied by, you know, a process of making sure that the accurate history is taught, an examination of the policies that maintain, you know, a racist power structure. Those are the kinds of things that we have to push for. So I'm really glad to see that now, you know, we had, like, in Maryland, they went and took down monuments overnight. Obviously, in Charlottesville, it's still kind of a tense issue, but the city council there voted to remove the monuments. In Louisiana, they took monuments down. So it's great that it's happening, but we can't just stop there. Like, we really have to go the next step, which is really addressing racism as policy, racism as social practice.
Would you see something like in South Africa where they had, you know, the truth and reconciliation process? That was, you know, pretty successful considering their history.
Well, yeah. I mean, so I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina, and, you know, we had an uprising here a year ago. It's been just about a year. And one of the things that we have done since that time was actually examining the possibility of a truth and reconciliation type process. There was a truth and reconciliation process that was done in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well, that was modeled off of South Africa's process following an incident that they had there in the 70s. There was a clash between the Ku Klux Klan and communists who were marching there that resulted in several people being killed. So I think that there definitely is a need for some kind of process, right? Because part of what we are confronting now is the fact that our country never really dealt with it. We, you know, we had the Civil War. We had a period of Reconstruction that only lasted for about 12 years before it collapsed. We had, you know, a president, President Lincoln, who was assassinated, you know, as a result of his calling for free black people to have the right to vote. And then we had 100 years of segregation that followed that until the civil rights movement. So we really have not ever had, you know, a full official, you know, kind of process where we like really talked about everything that happened and really resolved it. So I think there's definitely, you know, a need for that. I don't know if it would kind of happen at a local level, kind of like city by city, state by state, or a national kind of process. But that is just something that we have never really undertaken in this country.
Yeah, it really seems, you can't take shortcuts sometimes. You've just got to go through the thicket.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, that's it. You know, well, you've been doing some amazing activism work. Maybe give people a background, of your life, how you fell into this or climbed into this up a flagpole, one might say.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I never had any aspirations of being an activist. I don't know that anybody does, right? I think for the most part, I'm just kind of speaking from most of the people that I have encountered who, you know, identify as activists and organizers. You know, it's mainly that we encounter some kind of injustice or, you know, we witness something that you know, kind of sparks us toward devoting ourselves to making change. And so that was certainly the case for me. You know, I'm an artist and, you know, most of my life has been just kind of focused on being an artist and, you know, kind of pursuing a career in art and entertainment. I did grow up with my parents were educators when I was growing up, and my mom did a lot of work around kind of closing the achievement gap. So I think, you know, issues of justice, especially in education, is something that's kind of, you know, I've always been aware of. But for me, it was really around 2012 and 2013, that's when the Trayvon Martin case happened. And that was really kind of a turning point for me. I really see Trayvon Martin as kind of the modern Emmett Till, like in the same way that the lynching of Emmett Till in 1955 was one of the, you know, kind of sparking moments for the civil rights movement of the 60s. I think that Trayvon Martin has had a similar impact, not just on me, but, you know, on millions of people. And it really did lead to, you know, this modern movement, I would say, that we are experiencing now. And so when that happened, when Trayvon Martin happened, I was in New York. I ended up coming back to North Carolina where the Moral Monday movement was going on, organized by the state chapter of NAACP. And in that same summer of 2013, that's when the Supreme Court struck down, you know, key parts of the Voting Rights Act. And so North Carolina had started this attack on voting rights. And so, you know, kind of the combination of those things, it was just kind of this moment for me where, you know, I had to ask myself, how much am I taking my rights for granted? You know, can I really afford to not, you know, really dedicate myself to addressing these issues? And so that's really kind of where I've been since that time, just very active in really pushing for not just for change, but also in just preserving our rights, because I feel that so many of our civil rights are under threat right now.
Oh, my goodness, yes. At every direction, it appears. But are you giving your art some space in your life?
I am. And I think I really am trying to be more intentional in terms of finding space for that. I think that there's a lot of power in art and communication, you know, when we're talking about kind of the hearts and minds part of it, you know. So one part is policy and changing laws, but it's hard to make that happen until we change hearts and minds. And I think that there's a lot of power in art to do that. Even really in scaling the poll, I mean, it was a direct action. It was about policy in terms of, you know, changing this law that was protecting the display of the flag at the State House grounds. But it was also art. It was also like performance art, because here we had a symbol, you know, in this Confederate flag, and we were creating a new symbol in this image of, you know, me as this black woman scaling the pole and unhooking the flag. And, you know, one of the things that we saw come out of that was, you know, all of these artists creating all of these amazing depictions of that moment. You know, and I think that kind of speaks to the power of communication.
Well, and obviously that particular protest, as you say, was vivid and made a difference, because you took it down and obviously they took it up, but then they actually had to discuss it and then decide to officially take it down. So the
right. And see, even in them saying, because, you know, up until that point, they were saying, well, yeah, it should come down, but we can't because of this law. And, you know, our mm-hmm. our whole argument was, you know, but the law itself is unjust. Right. And so by, you know, we take it down, then we force South Carolina to make the decision whether to leave it down or to raise it back up. And of course, in that minute, they raised it back up. But that put that pressure, you know, that extra pressure on them to eventually take it down.
Yeah, pretty wild. And that wild and crazy judge is running again, wasn't he, for the Republican seat, wasn't it? That was a Sessions seat. I'm getting mixed up here.
Alabama,
uh-huh. Yeah. The Moore, that's right, the... Because he was that was something that set things off when that Judge Moore wanted the Ten Commandments on the outside his state house, wasn't it?
Yes, I'm not entirely sure about that. Are you talking about the one that was hit recently?
Yes, exactly. Interesting. I mean, and this is both sides. I mean, we've got, I hate to say it, the many sides things, but obviously people are taking up their, what would you call it? They're getting activists on both sides. When you're on the lines, what is the per se other side like when you're out there? Can you give us a feel of being there?
Well, I mean, it kind of depends. So now I have not been present for, you know, like some of these more recent protests where you have white supremacist organizations in the street. Most of the protests that I have been present for, the kind of antagonistic side on the other side was the police, because we were protesting police murders.
Right.
And so, you know, I've been present for some protests where it was pretty intense. One of the most intense, I would say, was a march we had in Bladenboro, South Carolina, following the death of Lennon Lacy. This case didn't get as much attention because it came kind of around that same time where we had high-profile police killings. But Bladenboro is a small town in North Carolina, and there was a young black teenager who was found hanging from a swing set. And there were just a lot of very suspicious circumstances, you know, kind of surrounding his death. And so we went to march, and it was, you know, it was very, very tense. They had shut down all the stores in Main Street. And, you know, we came to one point, you know, we're marching with the NAACP, and we get past one point, and the police are just kind of standing on the side in uniform alongside, you know, other white men who are not in uniform, who I think it's pretty safe to, you know, assume are probably white supremacist groups. So, you know, that has been kind of more my experience. But when I saw, you know, what unfolded in Charlottesville, and I know, you know, many of the activists who are involved there, including some of the clergy who were attacked by white supremacists, I mean, that did not come as a shock, because in many ways it's kind of been building. You know, it's been building to this point. And so what we're seeing now is like the organized response from white supremacist groups.
Interesting. So it's, that... the build of the iceberg getting to the tip, protruding out.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Do you think it's, you know, it's hard to know. I mean, how many are there? I mean, we saw that example there in Charlottesville. You know, how much actual sympathy is there, do you think?
For white supremacists?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the fact that Donald Trump was able to get elected, I mean, that tells us a lot. Now, he did not get the majority of the vote, right?
Right.
But there's still a critical mass that supports him, or that he has, like, a critical mass of active support that is, like, kind of diehard support. But he has enough folks that are, you know, sympathetic that have made his kind of rise to power possible. And so that is, you know, that's concerning. I think... Again, I'm glad that we can, you know, when we look at the election results, that the majority of Americans, you know, by more than 3 million, did not support his candidacy and, you know, the kind of message of white nationalism that he ran on. But it's still something that is, you know, very dangerous. And the fact that he is now in power, and the fact that he clearly is aligned with, you know, a lot of these groups, and, you know, he's talking about... you know, giving more military equipment to the police. And, you know, he just pardoned, Arpaio. All of these, he's talking about, you know, maybe giving a position to Sheriff Clark. Like, all of these things just point toward trying to, you know, take the country more toward fascism, toward outright fascism. And I think that it is dangerous when we look at history. I think it's dangerous for us to think that that can't happen in the United States.
Oh, yes. my goodness. Very easily. And, well, that's it. You know, and the scary thing is he's so blatant about it now. It doesn't seem to be a problem to even deny it.
Right. I mean, exactly. There is no, I mean, there's no sugarcoating anything. They are very blatant about it. So, I mean, and the fact that they feel that comfortable being blatant about it, I mean, I think that should be even greater cause for concern. You know, a lot of what got attention in Charlottesville was, like, you know, the clashes between the white supremacist groups and Antifa. But one of the things that I found most alarming were, like, the reports of, you know, people being in the synagogue on Saturday, and there were Nazis outside marching and yelling, and the police didn't provide any protection, even though, you know, the synagogue had asked for protection. Like, things like that are very alarming. And we have, we now have a Department of Justice that is not, you know, willing to really actively investigate anything, not really looking into, you know, the possibility of white supremacist infiltration of police forces, you know, really trying to pull back on the civil rights division within the Department of Justice. Like, all of that is very alarming.
Well, that's it, isn't it? They're doing it right out in the open. That's what makes it so jaw-dropping. It used to be, you know, smoke-filled back rooms. Why bother?
Right, exactly.
Ooh. Well, we're speaking to Bree Newsom. And, wow, bringing in a very interesting perspective to what we've got going on here in America. As I was saying, California obviously wasn't touched by the Civil War. Funnily enough, there was one, like, minor skirmish, actually, just about, there was only one battle in the whole of California, and that was about 15 miles away between some people from Santa Rosa and some people from Petaluma. But it was at a roadhouse, and they all got drunk, and their wives took them home before it got serious. So that was basically our involvement in the Civil War.
Well, but, I mean, direct involvement in the Civil War, right? But in terms of, like, the aftermath of the Civil War and, like, the, you know, droves of black people in the South being driven because of the terrorism in the South out to California, and then, you know, out in California encountering another, you know, level of racism. Obviously, there's a lot of tension in Oakland and L.A., you know, had the L.A. riots in 92. Like, all of that, you know, comes from, you know, another history that, again, is directly connected to the violence in the South.
Well, that's a very good point. We are one country, and it is all connected. That is definitely something to remember. And, last week you wrote something in the Washington Post. You wrote an opinion, which was very impressive, about the monuments. And maybe you can give us a view of what you think of the monuments. What should we do with them?
Well, I think they should be taken down. I mean, people have, you know, put forth some other, you know, kind of options. People have said, well, let's put, you know, plaques next to it that, you know, explain what it is and things like that. But I mean, I don't see the purpose for that. Like, I think it would be different, maybe, if these were monuments that were erected, you know, during the Civil War, like, so they actually have a direct connection to Civil War history. Even then, I would kind of challenge, you know, what is the necessity of these monuments? But again, these monuments were built in between, like, the early 20th century and, like, the late 60s, you know? These monuments were built as statements against the civil rights movement. They were built as monuments to white supremacy, and that's the only historical significance that they represent. And they continue to be a problem in terms of, you know, perpetuating miseducation, because the way that we, you know, commemorate things, the way that we, you know, put up monuments and things like that, it says something about how we are remembering the history. Mm-hmm. So it's not simply, like, if we have a monument to, you know, Jefferson Davis, you know, as we do across this nation, that's not simply saying Jefferson Davis was the president of, you know, the former Confederate States of America that, you know, seceded from the Union to preserve slavery and that cause was wrong. It's a statue glorifying Jefferson Davis. It's glorifying the cause. You know, it's glorifying him saying that African slavery was, you know, a moral and social blessing, you know? So there's no real way to keep something like that up and not have it symbolize exactly what it means. So I, in my view, I think that, again, like I said, we need to have a campaign of taking these monuments down, and it needs to be accompanied by education. You know, if we take down, for instance, in South Carolina, taking down the flag, that's not enough. We need to also talk about what was going on in 1961 at the time that this flag was raised. You know?
Good point. What brought it to that point? What was their fears, their insecurity, which brought it to that point? Now, obviously, Trump brought up the whole moral equivalency of George Washington and having statues for him being a slave owner. How do you see that?
Well, statues to George Washington, yes, George Washington was a slave owner. That is true. But the United States of America was not founded for the purpose of preserving slavery. There was a debate that went on at the time that the United States was founded over whether or not slaves should be emancipated. And not all of the founders of the United States even agreed with that. You had, like, the second president of the United States, John Adams. I don't know why his name is never brought up, because he was an abolitionist. He opposed slavery, you know. But a monument to Jefferson Davis, a monument to Robert E. Lee, this, the Confederate States of America existed for no reason except to preserve slavery. The United States of America came into existence to separate from the rule of England. Now, you know, the Revolution, in my opinion, did not go far enough in terms of liberating the people. Obviously, that's still something that we are working towards today. But to say that there is an equivalence in terms of what the, you know, what the American Revolution was about and what the secession of the Confederacy was about is just historical. That's just ahistorical.
It's a wide gulf, in other words, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and as what you were saying, it really goes back to who can vote. And that's huge now, obviously. I know that's something you've been working on a lot. Voting, enabling people to vote. Where are we with that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an ongoing struggle. I mean, voting is, that's like the basic element of the democracy, right? So I mean, the definition of a democracy or a representative democracy is about having a citizenry that has the ability to vote and have, you know, a say in government. And so that's why the, you know, the right or the denial of the right of Black Americans to vote, like since the foundation of the nation, again, going back to when the nation was first founded, and there was a question about, you know, can we really call ourselves a free nation if we maintain the system of slavery that, you know, was with us during the colonial period. That's why that question has always been central to the issue of whether or not the United States is a democracy. And it continues to be an issue. So even in North Carolina, we have an issue, an ongoing issue, not simply with securing people's, you know, ability to vote, to exercise their right to vote, but we also have this issue of gerrymandering. So, like, you have officials gerrymandering the districts in such a way that even if people are able to exercise their right to vote, they are still not being properly represented in the government. You know, so again, as one who believes in democracy and representative democracy and in pushing America towards becoming not just a relative democracy, right? Because oftentimes we speak of America as being democratic relative to autocratic regimes around the world, you know? And I think we can do better than that. I think we need to push towards being an actual, realized democracy. We have to look at all the ways that the power is structured and who actually gets to influence the levers of power.
Yeah, exactly. And now, in your state, obviously, you've had quite a brouhaha, obviously, and a Democratic governor took over by the skin of his teeth. How's he doing with rolling back some of those onerous bills that the Republicans put in there?
Well, it's a bit difficult. I mean, in North Carolina, I would argue that North Carolina, in a lot of ways, kind of presaged what's happening nationally.
Mm.
So in 2008, we had North Carolina voted for Obama, and that was the first time that the state had voted for a Democratic president since the Civil Rights Movement, obviously in reaction to the Democratic Party in the 60s supporting the Civil Rights Act. And so you had kind of like a racist reaction in North Carolina. The election of Obama in North Carolina had a lot to do, you know, with certain factors that we have in North Carolina. We have a lot of schools here. The students have really emerged as a powerful voting bloc. And so then in 2010, when we had Republicans basically take over the legislature here in North Carolina, they started passing a series of reactionary laws to basically prevent what had happened in 2008, which included, you know, attacking black voters, as has always been the case, but also attacking student voters. And so part of the challenge that is faced here in North Carolina, it kind of reflects what's happening nationally. Yes, we have, you know, a Democratic governor, but the Republican legislature is overwhelmingly, the legislature is overwhelmingly Republican. And as I mentioned before, the districts are really gerrymandered in such a way that it's very difficult to change that. And when you look at like the national picture with the House of Representatives, it's a very similar kind of thing. The legislature is overwhelmingly Republican, but that doesn't really reflect a lot of the views of the Americans. But the way that the districts are set up, it pretty much makes it impossible to really challenge things. And so that leads to kind of more radical, far-right candidates being able to survive the primaries, and get into office.
Right. Wow, what a conundrum, isn't it?
It really is, yeah.
Wow. And of course, amongst all this, there's a lot of rights for women that seem to be going out the window as well. Trump just took away that transparency of wages for women. That just went today or yesterday, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, well, absolutely. That is part of the oppression, right? So when we're looking historically at the United States of America and the way that the power structure was established in this country from the time that it was a colony, the oppression of women has been a part of that, the oppression of black women. I mean, that is largely what the economy was built on from the time that, you know, chattel slavery was the law of the land. And so you can't really separate the issues of, you know, access to reproductive rights, access to, equal pay. All of those things are used to oppress women, and it's an economic issue for women. And the way that it works, I mean, these are intersecting issues. So the ability of a woman to have access to equal pay, that impacts her ability to have a say in the power structure, because obviously there's a connection between economic power and political power. That impacts how much freedom she has in terms of just being having agency as a human being. I mean, for so much of the history, women have really not had any kind of agency because their ability to survive has been tied to the economic position of the men in their lives.
Right.
And so, you know, it's an economic issue, it's a social justice issue, it's a reproductive right issue, it's all of those things. And when, you know, these measures that Trump is taking, it's really just an effort to turn the clock back on all of those things. It's really an effort to take us really back to, you know, the pre-civil rights era, because so many of these benefits that we are seeing now in terms of the rights that we have were a byproduct of the civil rights era.
That's a very good point. It taught people how to fight for their rights.
Exactly.
A whole generation.
Exactly.
You know, and that's the thing. How do you teach people to fight for their rights? How do you make them stand up and do that, Bree?
Well, I mean, I don't know if I can say that I'm an expert on that. Like, that's something I'm trying to learn and figure out as I go, but that is certainly the goal. I think that, you know, what I view as the goal and as the solution, it's really about shifting power. We have to shift power from the few to the many. You know, again, I don't think that we can call ourselves a fully realized democracy until everyone really has the right to participate. Right. And so part of what we are trying to do is just make it possible. And when we are organizing, as I am, in populations that are historically oppressed, you know, one of the issues is that it's hard for people to organize themselves when they are caught in a cycle of living day to day. You know, so if you are impoverished, you know, and you're living paycheck to paycheck, most of your energy and time, you know, has to go to basic daily decisions like that. Do we pay the light bill today, or do we buy medicine today, or can we afford food today? You know, you don't necessarily have time to say, okay, yeah, let's organize a community meeting to ensure that we have voting rights. So let's organize a community meeting to show up at this development meeting that the city is having, because, you know, they're planning this transportation route that's going to impact us. You don't necessarily have time for that.
Right.
You know, so it's not simply, you know, a matter of how do we increase democracy, but we're also trying to dismantle oppression and systems that are deliberately set up to make it difficult for people to access power or to really have representation in the government.
Exactly. That's the thing, isn't it? Getting reclaiming what should be. Isn't that interesting? We turn our eyes away and the vacuum will be filled, won't it? And not in the way we want.
Right.
Yeah. So how do you see yourself over the next couple of years, where you're going and what type of projects you'll be working on?
Well, there's one kind of project that I'm really interested in, and I didn't create this, but there is kind of like a meeting format called the People's Power Assembly, or the People's Movement Assembly. And like I was saying before, you know, part of the goal is to really try to shift power, and how do we really increase democracy? How do we move towards having more democratic structures? You know, part of the kind of like issue that we confront is that we have a very top-down, you know, type power structure. So you have really like a handful of folks. I mean, we really are an oligarchy at this point. You really just have like a handful of folks who are pretty much making all of the decisions. And you have a kind of mass of people who are really kind of disconnected from the power structure. And I think we see that playing out in many different ways, including, you know, you see people kind of being disenchanted with both of the major political parties. So one of the things that we're trying to do throughout the South is organize these meetings called People's Power Assemblies. And this is basically how we bring a community together to, you know, assess, okay, what are the issues that are facing the community? And then how do we, as a community, develop, like, what kind of policy or what kind of platform agenda do we want for our community? And then really kind of restructuring the power so that people, based on that agenda that they want as a community, are then, you know, engaging with the civic process and really pushing for, you know, for their agenda through the levers of power. I mean, I know I can speak for myself. There's a lot that I didn't know about, you know, well, how exactly does a policy get passed? Who makes the decision at a local level? You know, who is making these decisions? And so we want to do more education for local communities so they understand, you know, how policy is made and then how they can really push for the policies that they need in their local community. So that's one of the, you know, kind of primary things that I've been focused on. And then, as I said, you know, really focusing on how to use art and communication as a, you know, really as a tool of education, as a tool of empowerment and enlightenment.
Well, that's it, isn't it? You have to come from the passion and the love you have, and art is very important to you, so it makes it doubly more powerful.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, in that way. And so any upcoming events people should know about over the next days or weeks coming up?
Well, I would say, like, visit my website, BreeNewsome.com, BreeNewsome.com. That's where you can see. I'll have a calendar on there. Hmm. I'll actually be out at Cal State Northridge later this month. But I have, you know, times where I speak publicly, and so if you, you know, are interested in seeing me speak, I have on my website where you can, you know, kind of see what my upcoming events are. And then, of course, I'm always on Twitter kind of sharing, you know, what I feel about current events. And I'm at Bree Newsome on Twitter, so you can connect with me there as well.
Oh, great. Well, I hope people do that. Keep up the great work. We need people who inspire us, and I think you're one of those people, Bree, and I just pray you keep doing it and inspire more people, and we right the wrongs there.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Bree, and thank you so much. Good luck.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
With the pines, anyone can see why.